Yet another reminder, soccer-loving P1s, if you're looking for holiday gift-giving ideas, you gotta check out soccer90.com. It is your source for all things U.S. national team, your favorite club gear, or national team gear from all over the globe. In fact, right now, appropriately, the MLS Cup playoff sale's going on. Hats, tees, and jerseys all on sale at different prices across a various set of dates. You may want to go check out those at soccer90.com. They have a Black Friday sale coming up on Black Friday, appropriately, at 10 a.m. 50% off everything in the first hour, and then 40% and then 30% off the rest of the weekend, both in-store and online. And then on Cyber Monday, a Cyber Monday sale, 40% off everything online only. So like I always say, if you happen to be up in Frisco, go check out the actual brick and mortar store right there next to the Hall of Fame on Main Street in Frisco. And always, just go get your stuff over at soccer90.com.
It's time for the Kick Around, the Ticket's weekly show all about soccer. It doesn't matter if you're new to the sport, don't worry. This is the Tick. We're just kicking it around. Now, two guys who can never go the full 90, Andy Swift and Peter Welton.
Well, hi-de-ho, P1s, and welcome to today's Kick Around, the podcast. Normally Saturdays 2 to 4 on Sports Radio 96.7 and 1310 The Ticket, where you, the good P1, sits around, talks some soccer and all that implies. For those new here or unfamiliar, hi, my name is Peter. Good to speak with you. Amazingly, my soccer-talking BFF of all days, Andy Swift, the good Liverpool fan, is not available. And it's a sad, I'm sure he's going to be disappointed to miss, because we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the firing, the sacking of Manchester United's manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who was sacked after the brutally embarrassing, yet another brutally embarrassing result, maybe the worst of all of the ones they've had of late, 4-1 at Watford at Vicarage Road. What a murder that was yesterday. Quite the scenes. And because Andy is not available, I went out and tried to find the best alternative possible. So lo and behold, what did I do? I dialed up the internet, and now live from London is our good friend, noted football journalist, the Norwegian living in London, Lars Sivertsen.
Good morning, Peter. How are you doing?
Are you in a national state of Norwegian mourning?
We are. I mean, we're all sort of, the flags are on half mast, and, you know, parents across the land are trying to find, how do we talk to our kids about this? And, you know, how do we explain?
Will school be canceled tomorrow?
Oh, yes. A national day of mourning will be constituted. No, I actually would like to hear your take on this, because a lot of the sort of responses to this, you know, you see Phil Neville putting up a photo of like Solskjaer's winning goal in Barcelona and a heart emoji, and I mean, some of this, it's like he's dead. Like he's on one level, this is sort of, maybe this is slightly cynical side of me that's thinking, you know, a guy who has been under inhuman amounts of pressure has been kind of taken out of the firing line and is now going to be paid a rumored £7.5 million or something to go on holiday for a good while. You know what? That's not the worst thing that can happen to you in life. But then there is a human side of it, I guess, which is, this is the job he would have always wanted. You know, after retiring, this is the pinnacle of his professional life. This is the thing on the entire planet of all possible jobs. This would be the biggest one for Solskjaer to get. And for that then to unravel so spectacularly and so publicly, you have to just think there's a human being in the middle of all of this as well. And I should try to restrain myself from making too many jokes about it, I guess.
Yeah, if you're a fan of the club, it's an incredibly sad and frustrating moment, and it's a weird mix of emotions because he is a club legend. I mean, I wonder if this isn't dissimilar to how Chelsea fans felt with the whole Frank Lampard situation last year.
Yeah.
The problem for United fans, and this is really where the vast majority of my emotions lie, is that unlike Chelsea, United have zero plan, right? Like, Chelsea fired Lampard, and they had a solution in place in Thomas Tuchel, which, by the way, worked out spectacularly from the jump and continues to. And we'll talk more about that here later on. But United has futzed around with this whole Solskjaer thing for so long, and allowed so many other top class managers to go find work elsewhere.
Yeah.
When we all felt like we knew how this was going to end, that now they've screwed themselves into the ground with absolutely no solution in place.
And it is a very common truism in sort of football circles over here, certainly. Whenever you fire a manager who a lot of people want to succeed, people will say, oh, well, if United hadn't kept faith with Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, history would have looked very differently. But you know what? The counter argument to that is, if Arsenal had kept faith with Bruce Rioch, then their history would have looked very differently as well, because they wouldn't have hired Arsene Wenger. If Liverpool had kept faith with Brendan Rodgers, you know, they wouldn't have appointed Jurgen Klopp. I mean, there's an opportunity cost to sticking with a manager who's giving you very little reason to think he is up for it. And in the case of Man United, yeah, they've missed out on some names, who Tuchel being one of them, that they could have plausibly brought to the club, who would have very obviously been an upgrade on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
It's interesting, because if you reflect on the time that he's been here, there is a case to be made that Ole was the right guy at the time to repair a lot of the problems that were with the club post-Mourinho. There was fractures in the locker room, people didn't feel loved, and he came in and was this put his arms around you, love you, hug you kind of manager, and he solved a lot of those problems. But when it became relatively clear that he probably was just a little bit, or maybe way out of his depth when it came to that next level, you would have thought that people at this level of ownership and management and professionalism would have seen the winds blowing and said, okay, this may not work much longer. How do we, what is the next thing we do? How do we do this? And instead, they just stuck with it way too long, and now they're in a terrible, terrible mess.
That is a very good summary of where we are. And I think it should be noted, listen, there'll be no shortage of people dancing on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's professional grave. But I think it's worth noting that you're right. He did do a good job as the sort of the fumigator. Is that the right? The guy who needed to detoxify the building.
Yeah.
After Mourinho had sort of stunk out the place in every conceivable way and just made a toxic atmosphere that only Mourinho can conjure, and they needed people to just feel good about their lives again.
Well,
and he did,
yeah.
Like he did the thing, like the pest control. He put like the big tent around the building, and and got the gases either in or out, and cleared things up.
Yeah,
and I did joke at the time. I always felt people were overplaying the initial results a little bit. Nothing against Solskjaer, but there was certainly a point in United's history where they could have replaced Mourinho with a golden retriever and the results would have immediately picked up. I mean, they just needed someone who wasn't just a terrible guy in charge of the club.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talked a lot about that at the time, which was part of what, you know, maybe in retrospect helped and also hurt Solskjaer, was the fact that he took over the gig right at a time when Mourinho left, and suddenly the calendar got super easy. And he was able to take this incredibly talented team, kind of get the awfulness out of the room, and everybody started playing well enough to beat a bunch of bad teams in sequence. And then he got the result in Paris.
Yeah.
And that kind of put him on a trajectory of, hey, wait, maybe this is going to work. Maybe all of our dreams and romance of a club legend taking over will work for us like it did for Real Madrid. And, you know, it never flew very steadily from there.
And let's not forget just how lucky the result in Paris was. I mean, I know.
Sure, yes, but that's not what people remember, right?
The narrative is written by the winners and all of that. But, I mean, it was a very strange night, because if you look back at it dispassionately, they were incredibly lucky, you know, in terms of, I mean, they having almost no possession and very few shots compared to PSG that night. And then they win, and you cut to the studio here in England. You've got former Man United players in the studio saying, you know, this is how we play with young players and attacking. And it's like, what are you talking about? You were just, that's not what just happened. It was very strange. But no, you're right. And I, that was the thing that the more cynical members of the press pack over here were sort of joking privately that spring. all of these United wins are a problem for them because they're going to end up giving him the job permanently now if this continues.
Yeah.
And that's probably not what they should be doing.
I mean, last night or yesterday, the 4-1 loss at Watford is just a reflection of so much that is wrong with the club and the way that the players had become, almost to a man, a problem under Solskjaer in all sorts of different ways. And his selection, like, I will, one of these days, somebody's got to do like a Netflix series on the curious case of Donny van de Beek, because I want to know ultimately how they spent all this money to get this kid in. We all thought he was an amazing footballer that had a great future ahead of him. And I don't know if he did something to upset the manager. I don't know if maybe he's just a terribly lazy person in training or what it was, but how he, like, individually was unable to get into the club, so to the point where he puts Modric on for the Watford game, and Modric was horrible in that game. He couldn't move. I was recalling a few minutes ago with you before we started recording, early, like middle of the first half, he makes this pass out of the back to about midfield, and he blows it. It's an absolutely wretched pass. A player intercepts it, comes right at Modric, and Modric essentially just stands there and lets him go right by him because he can't move. And how you put those, how one player, a young, vibrant, young, up-and-coming player like Van de Beek, can't get a start in a game like this, there's got to be a better backstory than anybody seems to have reported at this point.
It's worth spending some time on this, actually. I know there's a lot to talk about today, but it's worth spending some time on Van de Beek because I feel like he's symptomatic for a lot of the sort of total absence of planning and a big picture thinking at United. Because if you look back to, let's go back to the Ajax years, or when he was playing for Ajax, when they had that great season and went far in the Champions League, and with sort of De Ligt in defense and Frenkie de Jong running around.
It's a great team.
I mean, great team. Dusan Tadic up front. Who would have thought of that? This is very interesting. Hakim Ziyech as well. Like, really fun team. What was Donny van de Beek's role in that team? I mean, he played as an attacking midfielder, but not necessarily like a creative number 10, but someone who was making runs into the box. It was almost like a Frank Lampard at Chelsea type of role. I mean, the thing he did so incredibly well for that team was timing runs into the box, where there would often be sort of interesting spaces available because they used Dusan Tadic as a number 9, and he would never be where a number 9 would usually be. He would drift around. So often that opened up some interesting spaces for Van de Beek to sort of time his runs into. And then he had Frenkie de Jong and Lasse Schoen behind him playing passes. So it was timing runs into the box. I'm not saying he can't do other things, but that was the thing he was extraordinary at Ajax.
Which, by the way, this goal he scored yesterday in that game was a timely run from midfield where he heads the ball in from Ronaldo.
So when he goes to England, I think his natural position is probably as, like, in a 4-3-3 as one of the midfielders who has license to break forward a lot. Here's the thing, that role doesn't really exist when United are playing now, certainly not with Bruno Fernandes there. And you know what, even if that role exists, you'd probably play Paul Pogba in that role, because he's Paul Pogba and he's kind of higher on the pecking order than Donny van de Beek is. Now, Donny van de Beek has played in Ajax in a more defensive role, what they would call a 6, as the deeper guy in midfield, what United is screaming out for. But he's played that role for a team that has like 70% possession in every game and is playing against, I don't know, like Den Bosch and these sort of weird teams in the Eredivisie.
No offense to the Den Bosch fans out there.
Yeah, sorry. That's not comparable to what he would have to do. If you do take Matic or McTominay or someone out of the team and put Donny van de Beek in, you need a lot more sort of like physical oomph and stuff. And again, maybe it's just worth doing when everything is going wrong. You might as well try it. But he's found himself just in a team where he doesn't have a position at all.
Yeah,
and the team has spent all this money to bring him in when there's no obvious place for him to be. And that's such a thing we've seen so much with United post-Ferguson, is that they make these transfers and they sign players who are really good, but there's no sort of particularly clear idea of how to put them into a lineup that makes sense. And it's very, very aggravating to see this happening over and over again.
And if there, man, if there was one particular moment in the game that probably quantified just what a fire, an absolute tire fire United is, was late in the game in injury time when he decides to sub in Jesse Lingard late in the game because they've scored a goal and now they need another one or a couple more. It's before they go down, you know, two more goals. And, man, Lingard, now we all know what happened. Lingard posts a photo on Instagram or whatever of him in a West Ham jersey, and all the reports are is that he's worked out a deal to leave the club and go back to West Ham or whatever. Did you see the scenes of him subbing in? Did you see the look on his face? You would have
strange.
Jesse Lingard literally looked like a guy who was about to get a colonoscopy or a root canal. He wanted to be anywhere else in the world than subbing on for Manchester United in that game.
Which,
in that moment.
I mean, to be fair, if you're getting a colonoscopy on the field at Vicarage Road, that's not the place for it. Really, it's very awkward on a number of levels.
I thought that was a really weird location for a gastroenterologist when I visited that stadium a few years ago. Like, I didn't know they did that here. Yes, no, it was a weird situation. And the fact that Jesse Lingard of all people have soured so much on the situation, him, Jesse Lingard. A kid that comes up through the academy and can't, and even in his form, he didn't get to start. He put on Martial instead of Lingard in that game, and I just thought that was.
But Lingard again is an example of what I would look to see is just abject incompetence from United in terms of just running the club. And I want to give a shout out to Michael Cayley here, football analytics guy from the Double Pivot Pod, often makes interesting points. He wrote this the other day. United lucking into a streak of hot finishing from Lingard heading right into the final year of his contract that conjured a market for him out of nowhere and just going, nah, we'll just hang on to him, is elite squad management, which I think is a very very dry. But I think, you know, the fact that Lingard did so well at West Ham and went on, has scored some great goals. But I mean, again, if you look at the underlying numbers, that run of finishing was probably quite unsustainable from Lingard. But it meant that this summer, for some reason, suddenly there were people who wanted to buy Jesse Lingard, which United, you know, it gives United a chance of raising some money and getting a squad player they don't really need off the wage bill. And they just go, no, you know what? We're not selling him. And then they're keeping him and not using him at all the next season. I mean, this is a sort of like big brain thinking that I don't understand what's happening.
Well,
at this club.
You know what it is. And it's another piece of evidence of something that I find frustrating. And I do think it's what separates the really good teams from others, which is this weird. You see it so many times, and it doesn't make any difference what league it's in or even what level, right? You see it all over the place, which is this weird disconnect between the people that run the front office, the people responsible for the technical directors, if you want to call it, and the people coaching the players on the field. And if there isn't a proper connection between those two departments of a football club or a soccer team, more times than not, that particular team is really crummy or isn't going to win championships, right? Depending on how fractured that gap is between those two departments. And in United's case, I think it's such a problem because of the Van de Beek signing and the Jesse Lingard situation and the Paul Pogba situation is a great example of this, where they've been drug around by the nose by Pogba and his agent for not weeks, not months, but years now, where, you know, is he staying? Is he going? Does he want to be here? Does he want to go someplace else? And it's such a distraction, and it's so bad, and it's just another element of just what a terrible, terrible tar pit of problems Manchester, my beloved Manchester United, are at the time, at this moment.
Yeah, and you know what? Just to flip it a little bit on Lingard, I actually think he should have been playing this season. And the reason I think that is, once you've decided to buy Cristiano Ronaldo, which I don't think they should have done, but once you've made that decision, there are a couple of things you have to accept. Now, Cristiano Ronaldo, to be fair to him, is still an absolutely unique penalty box predator and finisher. If you can get the ball to him near the goal, he will, obviously, but he still has that in him. And I want to like not be too hard on him because I have issues with him as a sporting character. But once you've made that decision to bring him into your team, you have to accept that you are now playing with a man down without the ball. because he does nothing when the opponent has the ball. He gives you nothing in terms of pressing. He gives you nothing. And this is something you have to accept and you have to plan for. And you need to have a very, very clear and strong defensive organization for the other 9 outfield players when you don't have the ball to compensate for this. And you need players on the field who are going to run a lot more than normal players do. You need attacking players around him who are going to work incredibly hard off the ball to compensate for the fact that he's just kind of hanging around. And for all his flaws, and he has a lot of them, Jesse Lingard gives you a lot of energy out of possession. And this is actually what they have to have. I think you can get away with having Cristiano Ronaldo in the team if you have maybe like Cavani and Lingard playing around it.
I agree.
Then that probably works.
Yes.
But with Sancho and Greenwood and maybe not so much.
And Rashford and Martial, who all are famously not, you know, that kind of player. You know what was continuously frustrating, and this has been going on now for several weeks, which is Bruno Fernandes, which is critical to this team's midfield and collecting balls and playing balls and getting the team progressing forward. Fernandes is spending way too much time high pressing, doing Ronaldo's work as a 9. Like, how many times do you see Bruno Fernandes running out of literally from dead center midfield to go chase the ball up to the goalkeeper or a center back that's standing in their own penalty area, and now Ronaldo's 20 yards behind him? And that's not how the system's supposed to work, because now your best playmaker in the middle of the field is 60 yards up the field if you in fact happen to get a turnover.
And of course, the other thing that happens then is that once you play through that press, which is easy because it's completely disorganized.
Exactly.
It means you only have 2 guys in midfield because Bruno Fernando has run off.
Yeah.
So those guys in midfield who are not very good to begin with are suddenly like outnumbered in addition to all of this.
And one of those is Matic, who's like a Lego figure. He can't
doesn't really move anymore. Yeah. And this is just a disaster. And this is why when we're talking about Ronaldo being the problem, maybe it's because I think there is a system that can work with Ronaldo in it, but you have to accept the consequence of the fact that you have a guy who has extreme abilities but also pretty extreme limitations, and you have to plan accordingly.
The weird irony out of all of this, Lars, is you know the system in which maybe Ronaldo actually works was some variation of Man City, where he probably could have gotten away with it because they had players that would have crossed the ball into him. Right. And wouldn't necessarily have only tried to dribble at defenders. And maybe he would have been able to do what Ronaldo does, stand in the box and finish from 18 yards, because Grealish or whoever else was throwing balls in the box, because they do that.
Yeah, but I would worry about, I mean, a key sort of tenet of sort of what makes Man City work is their ability to win the ball back fast, high up the field. Which,
true,
of course, becomes very severely limited by having Ronaldo as one of your front players. But again, we're talking a lot about Ronaldo. The thing I want to add on this point is, according to Miguel Delaney of The Independent, who is very clued up when it comes to Man United things, he's writing today that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer did not envisage Ronaldo in his planning for this season, and that he wasn't 100% sold on the idea of signing him either, but that he spoke to Sir Alex Ferguson and ultimately felt that such a goal scorer would give him a better chance of victory. Whereas Solskjaer wanted a defensive midfielder and was hopeful that maybe they could get Declan Rice in. And listen, as much as I'm not convinced Solskjaer could have ever been the coach to win United the league or take them back to where they should be. But if you, instead of signing Ronaldo, sign Declan Rice this summer, I think this season looks very different.
How many, look, and it doesn't even have to be Declan Rice, because I can see why United or West Ham was going to fight tooth and nail not to let go of him. But Basuma, Ndidi, I mean, there's a litany of other players that they could have made legitimate bids for. And
Indeed,
probably gotten them and really solved their problem. And I'm not a expert at this, but that position in particular was such a glaring spot of need. And you could have sold some players to make up the difference in the cost. And the Ronaldo thing, with all the romance that comes behind it, no pun intended, and all of the other reasons why they decided to do it. It does make you wonder how different this particular season looks if they didn't sign him and they had made some other moves and had a front line of Greenwood in the middle playing the 9, Sancho on the right and Rashford on the left. That just looks like a completely different team in every way, shape, and form.
Absolutely, and you mentioned Sancho. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his, but he's struggled so far, and that doesn't have an obvious place in the team because Ronaldo has to play with everything that means. And again, if they knew they were going to bring in Ronaldo, then spending all that money on Sancho doesn't make sense. Like, again, and this is all the sort of lack of joined-up thinking that you mentioned, and I'm going to try not to rant too much about it. I know we have other things to talk about. But, you know, people say, I've seen, like, pundits say, how can a team that has Ronaldo, Cavani, Bruno Fernandes, Rashford, Greenwood, all these great attacking players, how can they be so bad and be, you know, so far behind in the table? But I would just flip that on its head and say, you know what? This is also a team that needs to pick two out of McTominay, Fred, and Matic for every game. And I can completely understand why a team that has to do that will not be winning a title anytime soon.
Yeah, you know what, though? Here's the thing. At the beginning of the season when they signed Raphael Varane, I could have been convinced that Varane was so good at center back and fixed so many of the weird center back pairing problems that maybe the issues of McFred become a little bit less problematic. And to be fair, when Varane was in there, they were a much better defensive unit. Not great, but better. But giving up 4 against Liverpool, 5 or whatever it was against City, or however many they gave up against City, and then 4 against Watford, 15 goals in the last however many games. It's just
the funny thing is that actually mess. The City, you're right.
And Varane, by the way, wasn't available for any of those games.
The funny thing, it was actually just 2 against City, but it felt like 7.
It did, yeah.
Okay. It was so comprehensive.
I have PTSD.
They've lost 4 of their last 5 in the Premier League now, and they've been humiliating defeats. Oh, I mean, really, really awful. Not just defeats, not narrow defeats, but embarrassing defeats.
And not to rub this the wrong way, Lars, because I know this is your team. They did actually beat Spurs in this run.
Yeah, who were also in a state of like meltdown and self destruction, and players who very clearly didn't fancy their coach. And I do think so much of it. I mean, I may have mentioned it already because I think this is just really the core of the problem with United, is David De Gea coming out after the Watford game and saying, "We don't know what to do with the ball."
Wow. That was really, really shocking to see him say that publicly.
Well, first of all, it's true. It's something us mere mortals on the outside have been talking about for quite a long time. But to hear a senior squad player just admit that actually this team just doesn't know what to do in possession, first of all, the fact that it's true is, of course, unacceptable for a team of United's stature, but also that you have a senior squad member who's prepared to say that in public, that also tells you that they're no longer interested in covering for the manager. Like that is the point at which, you know, it does have to
Yeah, so change. A few notes about that. Over here in the United States, NBC went out of their way to show the video from two angles, from in front of them and from behind, of the post-game Ole getting the players to go applaud the fans. And this weird, I mean, it was so weird to see, because Ole's kind of in front of the group applauding, kind of apologizing, and Bruno Fernandes is behind him just gesticulating and making these wild arm movements at the fans about, hey, wait a second. And I think everybody's making assumptions on what he's saying, and I think the general consensus is he's saying, hey, look, it's not just his problem, it's all of us. We're all problem. And yes, Bruno, you're correct. When you swung wildly at that one ball that led to the opening penalty kick situation, that was the weirdest thing. Like, what are you doing, dude? I just thought all of that, the fact that Manchester United have gotten to the point where your star player is like having an argument, open argument with the fans in the away stands. You just never thought you'd ever see that.
No, to be fair to Bruno, he was, I mean, saying that after the game, that this is on the players as well, which is good of him to say, and then he's showing leadership, and he's certainly a good player they have there. But this is, you know, of course, you can't absolve the players of blame, but it's not, you know, it's not like every time you play badly and lose games, it's automatically the coach's fault. But in this case with Solskjaer and United, it's that they're so discombobulated and just so badly organized, which you just have to look at the management. And really, it's not just the defeats. These are historically bad performances, just not from Man United, But just for any team that's this well-funded in relation to the teams around them in the league, to be so completely outplayed as they have been in the last few weeks, I'm a struggle to think of an example of a team that's been this well-funded and looked so totally out of their depth. It's just a historic level of awfulness.
All right, so here's my question to you. Out of this entire run of the last month or so, if you really had to sit down and think about it and put a grade or a score or a value next to each one, what is actually the worst defeat? Is it losing at home so badly to Liverpool, your nemesis? Is it losing to Man City, your crosstown rival, in the way that you did, where you got embarrassed by them? Or is it losing to Farton Watford at Vicarage Road, not even like 1-0 or 2-1 on a late weird goal, but getting pounded 4-0. I literally don't know which of those three results is the worst of the three. They're all a shit sandwich.
So I guess if you step back and you think a little bit big picture and what it all means, The Watford one is the worst one because they had the international break to look at. To be fair, it's not like they had the international break to work with the players, because most of the players are international.
Well, he gave a bunch of them a week off.
But that was an interesting move. But the coaching staff had a week to look at what's been going wrong and to come up with a plan and to have meetings with the players and rally the troops and just to come up with something against a pretty bad Watford team. And then you don't just lose people. Yeah, that is. But I have to say, in spite of all that, I think the first half against Liverpool is just one of the most shocking things I've ever seen. I don't think I've seen, again, a very well-funded team be so outplayed to the point where it was like you wanted to stop the fight. It was like, this game has to be stopped. This is embarrassing.
Yeah.
Like this shouldn't happen at this level. It was kind of like if you draw a team from like the Vanarama National in the FA Cup and they turn up and they're all part-timers and it's all icky to look like, and you feel icky. Like the team shouldn't be doing this to them.
I love that you use the word icky in your punditry. I think that's...
But honestly, that's how I felt about the first half against Liverpool. It was really uncomfortable to watch a team that was so clearly like not at the level in any sense.
It was like an MMA fight where one dude is just bashing another dude on the ground in the face over and over and over, and you're like, are they going to stop this? Because he appears to be near death. Yes.
Yes.
That was
That's how it felt like. It felt like they just needed to stop the game somehow. And right. I don't think I've ever felt that watching one of the richest teams in the world before. I mean, this is what I'm saying about just unprecedented levels of a badness. And I mean, we started this by saying we should be careful. We're sort of dancing on Solskjaer's grave, and this is the thing: like, there is no one, I think, in the world who will be more hurt by this than him, because he is a true believer. He is a genuine Man United fan, which is why I feel like he needed to be put out of this misery, and this should have happened a while ago, honestly.
Yes, and what should have happened is that the front office should have not made him the villain in all of this, or the bad guy, or the problem. They should have cut this off months and months ago, and everybody could have looked back and went, man, they really did Solskjaer wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Before everything got to this point, they could have fired him and replaced him and gotten somebody else, any of these other world-class managers in his place, who now the problem is that guy's problem and not your club legend's problem. Because, you know, long-term, you and I both know, Solskjaer will remain in every way, shape, and form a club legend at Manchester United.
Of course,
And a lot of the stuff that we're all angry and frustrated about today will have kind of drifted off into the ether and will become somewhat of a subset of his story at this club, but it's still there, right? It's a scar that's on his record that I think all of us that love this club are upset about, because we genuinely love that guy. He means so much to this club's history.
Yeah.
And that's weird. So here's the thing, and we could talk about what happened. Now I want to talk about what is going to happen, because I think this is where this gets really interesting. Don't forget, Manchester United in about 48 hours have to go to Spain to play a Champions League game, and an important one at that, against Villarreal, who, by the way, has kind of had their number of late. And they got to do that on Tuesday. Tuesday. And, I guess Michael Carrick and Darren Fletcher are going to somehow do this. And then after that, on Sunday, they got to go to Stamford Bridge and play Chelsea, who look like they could beat anybody in the world right now. Then after that, they host Arsenal. And then I thought this would be one of the, you know, let's kind of take it easy on ourselves, but I'm not sure that's the case anymore. They got to host Crystal Palace.
Yeah. I wonder, I just had this thought now when you were rattling through this. So I was going to be, another thing I was going to be annoyed about this lovely, lovely morning is that it's baffling to me that they didn't have an interim appointment ready, just because the rumors and the reports have all been that the United leadership, as much as they wanted to give Solskjaer every chance of turning it around, there was a realization after Liverpool that this is not going to work out and they're going to have to prepare for making a change, which is a relief to me to hear, because it means that there are actually like sentient human beings in charge of that football club. But the thing is,
but they didn't act on it, Lars. They sat on their ass. They sat on their hands.
But this is the thing. If they made that realization back almost exactly a month ago, actually, how is it possible that they don't have an interim guy ready? How can it take a month to find someone who is prepared to take United until the end of the season just to tidy things over? But then you know what it might be? It might be that they actually know who the interim appointment is going to be, but they don't want to throw him to this Champions League game with no prep time and then throw him the Chelsea game.
Who could be the interim manager of such importance that you would manipulate your season that way? I mean,
the point is, like, you saddle him with this. It's a bit of a hospital to pass to begin with. Maybe, I mean, maybe that's the thinking. I honestly don't know.
Well, what I want to say, and I want to make very clear, and I'm assuming you feel the same way. Through the last 30 minutes or whatever we've been prattling on, I think I said at the beginning of this, my anger and frustration is not at Solskjaer, really. It's at the front office. It's at Woodward. It's at the Glazers. It's at everybody running the front office that somehow managed to F this up so badly when there were so many opportunities to just cut it off at the opportunity and build from there and make corrections. And they just repeatedly, time and time, opportunity after opportunity, available world-class manager after available world-class manager, just mutts this up time and time again. And that's where my frustration lies. Because here we are at this point. So United now, it's so ridiculous. United sit in seventh as of this morning, okay? Now, Everton and City are going to play here shortly in a little bit. In about 30 minutes, they're going to start playing. Everton, if they somehow were able to win that game sitting in 11th place, actually leap United in the standings up to seventh place and could push United down. In the form table, things are so bad for Manchester United. In the form table of the last six games, they are sitting in 18th place.
Yeah, it's not great.
Down with Newcastle and Aston Villa. So that, and by the way, Aston Villa now suddenly looks like things are going to be okay there because they had a nice win yesterday. So it's a terrible situation, but I do need your insight. Is how do you think this play? Is this a situation where they're just going to put Carrick or Fletcher or somebody on the sideline and let them just try to hold on as long as they can until they can get Pochettino or Zidane or somebody to come in here and take this job full time?
Well, I mean, the statement they came out with seemed pretty clear that what they look to do is to appoint an interim coach until the end of the season, which, as much as we've been trashing the United leadership, I think is the sensible thing to do. Because I'm not sure who you would get right now who makes sense to be like the man to take this on. And whereas in the summer, of course, you can have options. It's possible that, if PSG, it's possible that Pochettino is sort of had enough of Paris by then and the chaos of that club.
Which club is in a bigger mess right now?
Well, but at least they're winning their league games. But then again, with the financial discrepancies in Ligue 1, that's kind of like taken for granted. It's a really strange club, that. But maybe you can convince Erik ten Hag to come over if that's a good idea. But the point is, in the summer you have options, and you give yourself a lot of months to talk to people and to chart out a course. So it does make sense to have an interim appointment until the end of the season. But the thing you point out is that, you know, you still kind of got to make that Champions League spot to keep the numbers ticking over financially. And just because of being out of the Champions League is terrible for a club like Manchester United. And currently, that's not necessarily a given that they can achieve. And I do wonder if that's one of the reasons why Tottenham acted so decisively and expensively to get rid of Nuno and bring Conte in, because they were kind of looking at Man United and thinking there is a spare Champions League spot potentially going this season, so it's actually worth taking the gamble on Conte.
You know, the other thing is people talk about what a good roster that remains, you know, star players that are filling out and somebody can come here and figure this out. But think about this. If you are considering taking over this club, and I don't know if somebody will see this as an opportunity or a problem, but Pogba more than likely is going to, I mean, he's injured. He's gone. I mean, will Pogba ever play in a United shirt again?
It's a crisis tunity, Dave.
Right? Okay. So
it's
Pogba's
a crisis tunity, Peter.
He's out of crisis tunity. He's out of contract and is likely to sign, because he can sign a deal in January to go somewhere in the summer, right? He can do that. Lingard's out of contract and already said he wants to go back to West Ham. Cavani's out of contract. Mata's out of contract. Not that we care about that. But you've also now got an unhappy.
He's there.
Eric Bailly's, you know, all sorts of unhappy. Van de Beek's all sorts of unhappy. You've got the weird Ronaldo situation. I'm not, you know, if I'm a world-class manager, unless somebody says I get to control all of this, which you're never going to get to do at United, I think that's another part of this equation that is a problem for United, which is while you are Manchester United and you're one of the biggest names and brands and of all of sport in the entire globe, I'm not sure this is the most attractive gig for just anybody who puts value in how they control a situation.
No, and I think you're touching on something important there. And it's also, when you look at some of the candidates that get mentioned, like Ralf Rangnick, a lot of people bring up. Ralf Rangnick, sort of one of the sort of the godfathers of modern German football in the way, you know, he sort of pioneered the sort of zonal pressing and all this, the way they, what we associate with Jürgen Klopp and those sort of German style of football. He's someone who, if you brought him in, he would want wholesale changes. You know, there's a lot of staff who he'd want to have thrown out and replaced by his guys. And a lot of coaches who you would want, who are big prestigious names, would think like that. Whereas every indication we're getting, I mean, I think it was the Telegraph was reporting that United feel that the changes they made bringing in Darren Fletcher and John Murtaugh in sort of directorial roles means that they're well positioned to sort of to mitigate any disruption caused by Solskjaer's departure. Like they seem quite content with the backroom staff as is. They just want another front, you know, another guy to be at the front of it. And I think that that's a real problem, because I think they need to get away from this United DNA stuff. I remember Solskjaer was asked about, when he was asked about his coaching staff and whether he needed to freshen that up, I think the words he used was that they were good Man United people. I mean, I'm going to double check that, but it was something about how they were good people and they were Man United people, and that's the thing. They need to stop appointing Man United. Like, just go out and try to find the most competent people. Who have proven, ideally, have proven elsewhere that they're very good at this. Like the amount of Man United DNA in their bloodstream shouldn't be a determining factor here.
I agree, and it's funny. There's a line of thinking that has popped up in the last few days that when Louis van Gaal was running Manchester United, he was adamant in the back staff and in meetings that everything needed to change, and he was pressing for that. And the problem is that this stepped on a lot of people's toes, mm-hmm. and upset a lot of the, you know, traditionalists inside the club. And that was, you know, along with the fact that they were really crummy on the field, but off the field, he created all sorts of noise for himself by saying, you guys have got this antiquated system, and if you want to keep up with everybody else, you got to do this, this, and this. And it's interesting that after all this time, Louis van Gaal may in some ways become a narrative of, look, you got it wrong way back then.
And I think if you look at a lot of the things Van Gaal has said he felt was wrong with the club, and actually, you know what, as much as I'm not a fan of his, a lot of the things Jose Mourinho said was wrong at the club, I think those are things you could still say are wrong at the club. I feel like those were people who at least the doctors found the correct diagnosis, but maybe not the correct cure. I certainly think neither the Mourinho cure nor the Van Gaal cure was what the patient needed in this case. But I think a lot of the things they bring up about the lack of football intelligence at the leadership level and this sort of thing is a real issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've spent, I don't know how long have we been doing this now? 30 minutes talking exclusively.
But it's more cathartic. Than that.
Yeah.
It's
well,
really good.
You know,
the listeners will decide if it's really good, obviously. But I feel on this day, this Sunday, it's actually quite good for my mental state to have a big chat with you about all of this, because we spent so many hours talking about Solskjaer and United over the last few years, and it is now over, and we need to get these thoughts into the air.
Yeah, well, I would say this to kind of put a bow on it. I have no idea who's going to end up taking over this club. I'm sure everybody's just going to run with the assumption that they're going to sit in a limbo state until Pochettino makes himself available, I assume, sometime next summer, and somehow they're going to futz around and try to pull out a European spot for next year. I don't know how they do that. It's all very TBD, and I'm sorry to anybody, any P1 that's not a Manchester United fan, that we spent 40 minutes talking about this. I know it's my club.
Hey. I can tell you one thing about football fans that are not United fans.
They love this.
They don't mind listening to talks about how bad United are. I mean, that's generally not... anyone who were alive during the 90s and covering football during the 90s, are finding this at least on some level slightly intriguing.
You know, Lars, in many ways, I just feel like this is deja vu from Cowboys early aughts, since that's what it feels very much like, to be honest with you, Lars. It's just a lot of really bad ownership and managerial decisions about who's going to run things around here, and it does feel a lot like that.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. Like, you say Pochettino, and I agree. I think I'm a huge Pochettino fan. You'll find few bigger Pochettino fans than me. But he's another, like, high-press manager. Let's win the ball high up the field. Let's everyone run. And again, you're still going to have Cristiano up there hanging around.
All right. So here's really, and this is probably...
waiting for the ball.
How many world-class managers are not high-press,
I know,
go win the ball up high-type managers?
Yeah, it's a real issue. When you have, and again, I don't want to it wouldn't sound like I'm being too harsh on him. He's a global superstar, and he can still do incredible things. But yeah, how do you make that work? I mean, the gods of football have done incredible work putting Pochettino in charge of PSG, where you have Mbappe, who doesn't run much off the ball, Messi, who doesn't run much off the ball, and incredibly, Neymar is the one the one who started putting in the work, and Pochettino's just standing on the sideline like, I miss Dele Alli.
You know, we had in 40 minutes.
Surprisingly hardworking boy.
Yes. So Manchester United is in all sorts of terrible ways. Ole is out. And we'll kind of keep everybody posted on where it goes from here. But yes, they do have a game on Tuesday in Spain against Villarreal and then have to go to Chelsea on Sunday. It could get very ugly before it gets any better. And by the way, they have to play Chelsea without Varane or Maguire, who got a second yellow against Watford. And so now you're going to get Lindelof and Bailly as your two center backs against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. It's going to be... I mean, imagine this is how it's going to go. They're going to lose 1-0 to Liverpool. They're going to get slaughtered by City, and then they're going to have to go face Chelsea and get slaughtered then too. And then that's followed up by Arsenal. I know I'm repeating myself. I'm just
good
trying
times.
To, yeah, it's terrible. Hey, I do want to focus on, because everybody else deserves their club talked about, because yesterday had a ton of really interesting results, because so many other things have changed since we last talked. Managerial positions at other clubs have changed, trying to salvage their seasons. But you got to pay attention to two results in particular, because it really starts to separate the wheat from the chaff. First off, Chelsea in the early morning game going to Leicester and making Brendan Rodgers' team look like it has way more problems at hand than we probably thought it did.
Yeah, and this was such a typical Chelsea under Thomas Tuchel performance, in the sense that not always like swashbuckling and super fun to watch, but just, you know, impervious, like just really sort of, they controlled the game totally, and they kept grinding, and you just knew You just knew that there was just no way Leicester were going to hurt them in this game. And they're so, again, you talk about, not to bring it back to Solskjaer again, because we talked a lot about him, but the way Tuchel went into this team, who under Lampard was good attacking in moments, but looked kind of chaotic, and again, very United Solskjaer-esque, actually, and just in a matter of a couple of weeks, just made them one of the most organized outfits in Europe. It's one of the most extraordinary feats of coaching I've seen in top level football in recent years.
Yeah.
And they do seem to be continuing. They've struggled a little bit with the balance up front this season. Lukaku, of course, has not, you know, hit the ground running as I frankly thought he would. Now with both him and Werner out there, they're having to use Kai Havertz as a striker, but they're just kind of finding ways of finding the goals, whether it's from set pieces, whether it's N'Golo Kante suddenly like turning into Messi and running around. They can hurt you in so many different ways, and the way they control games I think is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, Leicester are not having a great season, but this is still a Leicester team that has a lot of good footballers in it, and they had four shots over 90 minutes.
Well, they were missing Tielemans, and I think that is important to note because he's so critical to them operating well.
He is, but they have, you know, you rarely see them get like doinked on like this when they have Wilfred and Ndidi fit and healthy in midfield. And you very rarely see this Leicester team with the quality that they do have be restricted to just four shots over 90 minutes at home.
Well, how much of Rodgers' decision to switch back to a three-back line, three center backs, played in? Because when I watched this game yesterday, Leicester looked very out of sorts. They looked confused. I know they played three in the back very well last season, but they've not been doing it this season. And suddenly now he decides to do that to try to combat Chelsea, and they just didn't look like they knew what they should be doing.
I get what you're saying, but I'm in this game, I'm a little bit more sort of, I think Chelsea, when they're in this mode, are just incredibly difficult to deal with. And I think the list of teams in this division who can comfortably deal with Chelsea when things are going there, when things are working for them, is that list is very short.
Very short, yeah. Well, Chelsea, in fact, put themselves at the top of the table with that result. They now sit in first with 29 points, and we'll explain the four-point gap here in just a second. And then let's see, Leicester now is down to 12th. Somehow, Leicester is still behind Manchester United by 2 points, and that doesn't feel right to me. I don't know why that is. Now, the other result yesterday, and this was a game I was very much looking forward to. It was such a great barometer for Arteta and Arsenal and where things were going.
that's a mean way of setting it up.
Well, I really felt like Arsenal had played so well of late and really started to show signs of things starting to work out and, you know, new signings starting to produce, and then Liverpool just put their stamp on this game. And I would say this, Arsenal did not look as bad as a whole as Leicester did against Chelsea.
No, that's fair enough. But what I would say, and I wrote this in like a weekend preview before the weekend, is that this Arsenal run is very strange to me, because yes, they've gone on this run. I guess what is it? Eight games without a defeat. I think it's 2-2 draws and 6 wins in the last 8 in the Premier League, which is obviously a very good run for them to go on.
Yeah.
And very handy after losing their 3 first this season. But if you look at the teams they played, like they beat Norwich, they beat Burnley, they beat just an abject Tottenham who were just catastrophically bad in that game. Then they got a draw against Brighton, a draw against Crystal Palace, beat Aston Villa. And I think that first half against Aston Villa is probably the best I've seen them play this year, Arsenal. And then they got a very lucky, I would say, win against Leicester, where Aaron Ramsdale was amazing in goal, but he had to be amazing in goal. And it's one of those things, if your goalkeeper is having an amazing game, that's great, but you also got to wonder why he had to have an amazing game. And then they beat Watford without being good. So what I'm saying in a slightly roundabout way, yes, these have been good results, but I've never been fully convinced by the performances. And the results have come against opponents who have either been just not very good or in a slightly, you know, bad place. So I wasn't very surprised to see Liverpool win this. But of course, it should be mentioned, Liverpool themselves have had a couple of iffy results recently. So I think this was an important game for them to, you know, to put them back on track.
The other thing that happened in this game that, if you didn't watch, was really interesting was the spat that took place between Arteta and Klopp in the first half. There was a tackle. Mane kind of flew into the new Japanese right back.
Tomiyasu,
thank you. And it was, you know, it was one of those two guys going for a ball, and it was a foul. But for whatever reason, Arteta took great umbrage at this, and he and Klopp got into it. And I've never seen Arteta lose his wig like he did in that moment. Have you seen that video? Have you seen this?
Yeah, no, he does have a temper, Arteta. I've seen him angry before. But I have to say, like, I think if this was like a... If this was a fight outside a pub or something, I'd be my money is very firmly on Klopp here. I have to say, I think he's got more reach. I like to see this combative thing from Arteta. I think it's we've seen Arteta angry before, and I thought, you know, whenever you see scenes like this, you often hear the commentators, oh, well, we hate to see this. Well, we don't. We like to see this. It's fun. It's good. Like, let them be angry.
I don't know. If I had to see Klopp and Arteta in the octagon, you would put your money on Klopp?
Oh, yes. A lot of it.
Yeah, really? See, I wonder if Arteta isn't one of those sneaky guys that has, like, is, like, been practicing some sort of Spanish version of Krav Maga in the background, right? And he would just shock us all with his wily and speed and stealthiness.
Maybe.
No. Klopp would just meddle him to death. So Liverpool end up clobbering Arsenal. That game got disinteresting pretty quickly, and they end up winning. I mean, Minamino even scored in this game, 4-0. So Liverpool now sit 4 points behind Chelsea in second place, probably feeling pretty good about themselves. City plays Everton right now. In fact, they're playing. It's 0 early in the game, 0-0 early in the game against Everton. City could jump up to second place with 28 points with a win there. And then Tottenham and Leeds. Tottenham could position themselves above United in seventh place with a win over Leeds. Leeds, by the way, is a club interesting in its own right with Bielsa's situation. Any other news, like any sense over there as to the level of temperature of Bielsa's seat at Leeds at this point?
Well, I don't think he's under threat at all. I think his status in that club is very, very strong and high, and I think it's more a case of...
Whether he wants to stay?
Yeah, and whether I don't think their performances have been that bad either. I mean, they've got 5 draws in the 11 games so far, and that kind of tells you something. They've had some injuries that have been untimely for them. It's not the deepest squad, as we've discussed. I'm not fully prepared to go Leeds emergency crisis klaxon just yet. I think they'll snap out of it.
Well, it's an interesting opportunity for Conte and Spurs today, because Leeds is that kind of team that'll come at you and leave space behind, and that sets up so nicely for a Conte-led Spurs today.
You're exactly right about that, and I thought we saw some people were a lot of people were slightly underwhelmed by Tottenham at Everton last time out in Conte's first game, but of course first Premier League game. But of course, he had very little time with the team then, and I thought what you saw in that game is that the Tottenham players were very, very focused on their defensive shape. It was very clear that they were standing in the right places and sort of, you know, I think that's what they've been working on so far. And I think Conte, he's not as defensive a manager as some make him out to be, but I think with Tottenham, he's going to have to build it. What's the English, right? You got to put the foundation in place first here, and you got to make sure the organization is a little bit tighter than it has to be. And I'm really intrigued to see how this team looks today against Leeds. I think that's a really interesting match.
All right. Well, I know you'll put your Spurs jersey on and sit in front of the TV and get all excited about that. Now, there are other two results yesterday, and I can't quite... Actually, there were several results amongst the other teams that were surprising, and I'm just... Yeah. And not for any particular reason. I'm just going to go to this one first. I was shocked when I saw... Because I did not see the game, but I was shocked to see, and I don't know why, because this feels very West Ham United, but them to go and lose to Wolves yesterday, 1-0, and, you know, coming back from the international break... Antonio, who hit that absolute worldie against the United States and Jamaica the other day. You know, West Ham just felt like a team of destiny, like that effing team that was going to position themselves to really fight for a top four. But these are the type of results that they can't afford to be giving up if they're going to end up being one of those teams.
Yeah, no, this was disappointing, very disappointing for West Ham. And Wolves have been a strange team so far because they have certainly had games where they've played well and looked good. But then they have games like against Crystal Palace before the international break where they were just terrible. Like they're just really, really bad. But they were back in a sort of more positive mood here. And it's interesting to see Bruno Lage trying to make them a more attacking outfit. They're much more comfortable with the ball now. Now, I've got to hold my hands up. I was expecting a West Ham win here. I thought a team that's as good at countering as West Ham are, we're going to go and punish this more sort of positive ball-playing Wolves team. And they just they couldn't get it done at all. And this is a very, very disappointing result for them, of course.
Well, if you're not paying attention, and I always tell people, pay attention to the form table. Wolves currently in the last six sit third in the league terms of form behind Chelsea and Man City. So that's...
And I do think the Palace game was an aberration. I mean, but it was very strange because you're right. They have looked pretty handy recently. And then they just turned up at Palace and were just terrible. But I mean, I guess that can happen with these mid-table teams.
Now, the other surprise that caught me off guard, and maybe this is the new manager bounce, but Steven Gerrard makes his debut at Aston Villa against Brighton, a team that I really fancy and think has a bright future in front of them. In fact, I wouldn't be brokenhearted if Graham Potter got announced as Manchester United's new manager, although I know that'll never happen. But they got bounced yesterday. They got donut against Villa 2-0. Ollie Watkins and Tyrone Mings scoring late to make a 2-0 win. So everything's fine in Aston Villa land, right? Everything's good now, and Steven Gerrard's going to lead them back to good times.
Maybe it was very good for him to get a win on his first. Very few chances in this game, not a very lively one. And I guess this was sort of. This was sort of bad Brighton. This is, I'm also a huge fan. I'm also a huge Graham Potter fan. I did mention this on the show in the summer. I was kind of hoping he could maybe get the job at Tottenham. It's a bit of a leap, but I think he would have been a good shout for that. But his Brighton team, and I think he's doing an admirable job with not a lot of resources, but they do have occasional games where they have the ball a lot but don't do much with it. And this was just one of those. I mean, they had something like 63% possession and controlled a lot of the game, but produced, I think it was like six shots or something in the end. And they do occasionally have these games, Brighton. And Aston Villa, you know, duly pounced.
And then, speaking of managers in their first game, Dean Smith, who got the jump on Frank Lampard to get the Norwich job, made Southampton scores 4 minutes into the game at Norwich, but lo and behold, the amazing Pookie comes in 3 minutes later to tie the game up, and late in the game, Grant Hanley scores the winner for Norwich, and all of our canary-loving friends have got to feel a little bit better about their fate this season, because this is their first win of the season. Am I saying that correct?
They did actually beat Brentford.
Oh, they beat. Brentford. Right. Yeah, that's right.
But they were pummeled in that game. I mean, that was a very lucky win, and I think in a way, it's one of those things that speaks well of the front office that they didn't let that win distract them from the fact that the change needed to happen, because they were not better than Brentford in that game. There's no way for you to know this, but I feel like you're very much like strumming my pain with your fingers here in this episode, because one of the things I do for work is I write a weekly betting column, and I had a terrible one this weekend.
Let me also say this, Lars, for people wondering, I want to read that. Unfortunately, it's only in Norwegian.
Yeah.
And you have a podcast too that's only in Norwegian.
Listen, I'm Norwegian. You know,
I know.
So I write this column. And I like to think I'm pretty good, and it's one of those. You can check my historical results are pretty good. I had an absolute nightmare this weekend. Just nothing went the way I thought.
Record this weekend?
Just everything went wrong. I pitch a treble, three results, and then I make suggestions to three sort of single bets you can make as well. And I think everything I suggested this week went wrong, which is. I think has never happened before. Like, of all six, absolutely everything. Every single thing went wrong. And one of the things that went wrong was this game, was Norwich. I did not see the Norwich win coming. And in my defense, Norwich were absolutely pummeled in the first half here. The first half looked like more of the same, Norwich being atrocious. And again, they had one shot in the entire first half, and Southampton had 12, which is not great at home.
Yeah.
But credit to Dean Smith. He made some changes at halftime, brought on for our listeners. Joshua Sargent came on and made a positive impact in the second half. And they were much better in the second half, Norwich. And they managed to come back and get the win. And maybe, you know, across the 90 minutes, maybe not a result they fully deserved. But, you know, Dean Smith is starting to earn his coin there. I don't think they have a chance of staying up. I really don't. But it's good for them to get the win.
You know, Dean Smith feels like a really good fit at Norwich, unlike Lampard, because he's such a nice, universally liked individual. I know there's a lot of debate about his coaching qualities, but the type of team, the family-oriented kind of club that Norwich is, he just felt like a really good fit as a solution there. And maybe something will come out of it.
I agree with you. I like the vibe. And the thing to remember about Dean Smith, we remember him from Aston Villa, of course. But actually, before he was at Aston Villa, he was in charge of Brentford. And he was one of the coaches who sort of helped establish Brentford in the Championship when they were on their way up through the divisions, and did really well turning them into like a very positive, you know, a team that played good football on a very, very small budget in the Championship. So I think he is an interesting choice for Norwich, but I do hope they've made it clear to him that even if you get relegated, we're going to give you a chance to try to build this team up again. Because, again, I know they're actually above Newcastle in the table now, but their advanced metrics are not good. But they are the expected goals and all of this have them pretty squarely as the worst team in the league. Certainly did before this weekend.
Well, Lars, congratulations, because this is a great sub, because you mentioned both Brentford and Newcastle, which is the new game. And this is a game I think I need to go back and watch. Because holy cow.
I wasn't able to. Yeah, I have to say, ahead of this, again, this game ending 3-3 and Burnley Crystal Palace ending 3-3. I mean, if anyone had bet on that double, they could retire.
Yeah, you could make some money. So
Eddie Howe, unless the company you put the bet with would have gone under trying to pay you out, the odds for that would have been absolutely incredible circumstances. But yeah, I think we saw in this game something that we are expecting to see from Newcastle under Eddie Howe, which is that they're attacking a lot more. And I think that actually suits this squad, because they have some good attackers. And it was nice to see. I mean, this must be Joelinton's best game for Newcastle after he joined them. He looked like he had a place and a purpose in this team, which he hasn't often done. A team that attacks more should be able to get even more out of Alan Saint-Maximin, one of the great entertainers of this league. But you do worry about what's happening down the other end of the field.
So, because I haven't watched it, I haven't even seen the highlights. What tactical or formation changes did Eddie Howe make that made them more attacking?
So he set them up, and I think I would have laughed ahead of the. If you say this is the formation we're playing, I would have had a snigger and said good luck with that, because he set them up in like a 3-4-3.
Oh, wow.
With three proper center halves at the back, Clark, Lascelles, and Schär in defense. With Murphy and Ritchie as wing backs, which is fair enough. I mean, it's what you have. But then the two in central midfield, and hold on to your wigs and keys, was Jonjo Shelvey and Joe Willock.
Holy cow.
No, I'm going to, like, again, I have to, I mean, it did work in a sense. They didn't get annihilated, but I would have thought ahead of the game, you cannot play this formation with Jonjo Shelvey and Joe Willock in central midfield in this league.
By themselves,
I would have thought that there's no way that can work. But it was an exciting game, as you can expect.
Yes.
But the front three, I mean, Alan Saint-Maximin, Callum Wilson, and Joelinton. If you can get Joelinton to function in some sort of capacity, that's a pretty exciting front three. Positive early signs from Newcastle, who, again, created a lot of chances, but have defensive deficiencies, and they need a new goalkeeper as well. And in the end, 3-3, very exciting game.
Well, Lascelles scored twice, except one of them was for the other team, as he scored an own goal. And Brentford continues to get results here and there, and they're the surprise promoted team of the season. I think that's an interesting club. So I think I will go back and watch that one. And as Lars said, the other result and the last one of the day that we haven't mentioned yet is Burnley continues. Sean Dyche is working his magic as Burnley continues to improve their form as they Crystal Palace, a team that we all are. That's the surprise team of the season for us, other than Brentford, isn't it? That's my surprise team because I thought Patrick Vieira was going to drive that thing into the ground.
I agree.
They go, and that game's end up being exciting, too, is Burnley. And by the signing of the year so far, right, Cornet? Is he not the signing?
Yeah, terrific. I mean, Maxwell Cornet, and I laugh, and I want to give some context to why I'm laughing. So Maxwell Cornet is... actually, the context I need to start with is Burnley and Sean Dyche, because Sean Dyche has, as we know what he does, he likes big, strong men. He signs a lot of British players predominantly, which I think there's nothing about xenophobia or anything. I just think he wants a certain type of people and a certain football culture at his club. He's a bit of an old school guy, and they play, you know, it's all about winning your 50-50s and kicking the ball far away and all this stuff. So signing Maxwell Cornet was a bit of a departure for him, bringing in a French Ivorian player from Lyon. Now in France, Maxwell Cornet has played in a number of positions. He's played out wide as a winger on both sides, but last season he mostly played as a fullback actually for Lyon.
Really?
Left back. Yes, he was used predominantly as a left back for Lyon, and Sean Dyche brings him into the building and thinks, No, you're a striker.
You're a proper striker. You're my nine.
We can't have you. We're going to play you up front because I guess...
Is he playing him with Woods?
Yeah, he's playing as a forward. But here's the thing. It's working really well. He keeps banging in the goals. Wow. He's got five.
That goal he scored
now
yesterday was beautiful.
Yeah, there's been a few absolutely brilliant goals in there as well. So it's been a huge success.
If you have not watched Cornet's game-tying goal in the 49th minute yesterday, it's as nice a goal as we've seen all season. It's a fantastic strike.
Yeah, and he's hit a few of them. And like I said, it's a departure for Burnley to sign someone like that. But it also shows you, like, if you have a team that's maybe... that's built on very solid foundations and has a lot of big, strong men in them, but maybe not a lot of super talented technicians. If you just add one player who has a little bit of spice, then that can just add a lot to your team. And it's a great volley. Do check it out.
Well, if you didn't see it, ever so quietly, Christian Benteke scored a brace in this game, which is, when was the last time he scored two goals in a single game?
I mean, you've stomped me. it must have happened, but no. I mean, we laugh. Benteke, Vieira getting something out of Benteke. That's another thing we didn't see coming. And you mentioned we were sort of thinking, we should stress this. We weren't hoping that Crystal Palace were going to have a bad time. We were thinking it might go wrong. I think this is a pretty cool team. They have some young players in there that are exciting. But yeah, I have to say, Burnley Crystal Palace 3-3, not a result I saw coming.
All right, and just to put this into perspective, as of this morning, Sunday morning, before the City Everton and Spurs Leeds game, of the teams from 15th down to 20, which includes Aston Villa with a new manager, Burnley's situation trying to get out of the relegation form, and Norwich and Newcastle with new managers, all of them got results yesterday. Everybody. Now, we'll see what happened with Leeds, but Watford won, Aston Villa got points, Brentford got points, Burnley, Norwich, Newcastle all got points yesterday. So that's interesting at the bottom of the table, because you don't see that very often in these crummy teams down at the bottom. They all do well. And so now Burnley is sitting in 18th with 9 points, Norwich in 19th with 8 points, and Newcastle still remaining the only team without a win on the season with 6. And that's the day in action. I guess we'll see how the rest of it goes this particular on today to settle out the week. And now we go back into Champions League this particular weekend. Is there a game of a note other than the United situation in Villarreal that you're excited about?
I mean, obviously all eyes will be on United, but I think Manchester City playing Paris Saint-Germain is one I have a particular interest in, just because this Paris Saint-Germain project is so strange. they're such a weird team. I can't think of any equivalent, obviously, because they have some of the absolute best forwards on the planet in their team. But as we've talked earlier, the balance is all wrong. And like on in theory, it shouldn't work at all. And results so far have been pretty iffy. Now, they got very lucky in the first game between these two. Manchester City had a lot of chances that they missed. Now, PSG won in the end. But this rematch between, what should we call it? Like El Gasico? Is that what we're going with? The Petro State clubs. Listen, it's not my idea of how football should be, but it's fascinating that it's happening, I guess, and it's kind of hard to take your eyes off it.
I'm interested in the Chelsea-Juventus game because this could potentially be Weston McKennie versus Christian Pulisic. I don't know if Pulisic will actually end up playing a lot in this game. The reason why is there's been some rumors that there's interest in McKennie on some Premier League teams coming up, and for him to perform well against Chelsea, by the way, he's in terrific form, at least he has been for the United States, Lars, to see Weston make a move over the Premier League would be a big news story over here. I'm not sure that's necessarily where he needs to be, but that would be one to watch. I think will also be an interesting
I think he would be, I think whether or not they need anything in that position, I guess, is an open for a debate. But I think he would be an interesting Antonio Conte player, actually.
That's one of the clubs. I've heard Spurs and somebody else.
Very obviously a very physically capable player, but someone who, according to what I'm told from Italy, is that he's impressed people at Juventus with his sort of willingness to follow tactical instructions and to be a good soldier, put it that way. And of course, that's what Conte loves more than anything. So that would be an interesting fit.
And the other thing that just ever so quietly on Wednesday, the game maybe to watch of interest of the side of your eye is Real Madrid traveling to Sheriff in Moldova, and Transpondor, however that little weird...
Transnistria.
Transnistria.
Transpondor?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's the Turkish club that Fabian
Castillo...
Trabzonspor. Yeah.
From Trabzon. Very different. Transnistria, which is like a border region, which is... They've... It's one of those things.
It's the craziest story.
They've declared themselves a sovereign state. Like, we are a sovereign state, and everyone else went, no, you're not. And they've kind of been stuck in that situation since the early 90s.
Okay, so Lars,
but they play in the Moldovan League, which they win every year.
So I would highly recommend. The other day, Grant Wall wrote a whole article. Do you know? Are you know who Grant Wall is?
Of course.
Grant Wall traveled to Moldova and actually went to the stadium and talked to people and wrote a whole story about what ended up sounding like the craziest soccer trip of all time. You have to go read that story. It's really, really, really good. We've tweeted it out over at the Twitter account at the Kickaround. So that continues to be one of the better stories going around in the sport. So that's on Wednesday. All right, Lars, we've done ourselves good. Major League Soccer playoffs are happening now. I don't know if you're sucking up any of your late night time watching any of that goodness.
I really want to, but it's been a bit of a weekend. I don't know if you noticed, but maybe. I mean, I might try to watch it tonight, actually. There's me, New York versus Atlanta and the Timbers versus Minnesota tonight.
Those games are always sort of wheels off, Lars. Always wheels off crazy. They're one-off games, too.
I did see that my boy Glesner scored another banger for Philly last night, which is the center half who only deals in bangers.
Dallas isn't in the playoffs.
No, they're not. They're not in the playoffs, but they will be next year, my friend. Always look at it that way.
If I could only have the faith that you have, Lars.
The game I really want to see, I guess, will be on Wednesday over here, the Sounders versus RSL, just because of my sort of casual Sounders sympathies, since I spent some time over there and met some lovely people. Oh. But
we really need to correct that flaw in your personality.
It is scheduled for kicking off at 3:30 in the morning here on a weeknight, which is...
Just DVR it or tape it or watch it on demand or something, Lars.
Yeah.
Hey, and then last but not... Last but not least, do I need to provide you... You know, it's not a good... Along with the Ole situation with United, Norway is in a bit of state of shock because, if I'm understanding correctly, you have now officially not qualified for Qatar. You didn't even make the playoffs, did you? Your national team?
No, we had a slightly disastrous week where we actually played reason. I mean, I know this is going to sound completely ridiculous, but we played acceptably. Not maybe not well, but we weren't terrible. But we did draw against Latvia. Which is not good. But that was one of those. The first half was very bad.
Was it at Latvia?
No, it was in front of our own people.
Oh, no.
And in the first half, we were bad. In the second half, we created enough chances to win it, but we were very inefficient, in front of goal.
Erling Haaland's hurt. That's really your excuse, right?
Yes, that is the excuse. And Alex Sørloth, God bless him, had not a great day in front of goal. And then that left us in a situation where we needed to go to Holland and beat the Dutch, Louis van Gaal's Holland. And, you know, they're a better team than us, and it showed. We lost 2-0, and we were never very close in that game, and it is what it is. I think our qualifying campaign is more a near miss than a total disaster, if I can frame it that way.
All right. Always looking on the positive side.
Well, we were in a group with Holland and Turkey and us, and I think we're quality of squad between us and Turkey is probably pretty similar. And we ended up finishing very, very closely. And the thing that really was a problem for us was that our home game against Turkey had to be played in Spain in an empty stadium in Malaga because of the COVID situation. And that was only the second game under our new coach, Ståle Solbakken. So he had very little time to work with the team. He made some tactical decisions in that game, which I think he'd, if he had his time again, he would do things differently. And that was the key game in the group for us. And it came both at a bad time and in a bad place. So when we lost that, it was always going to be very, very difficult. But of course, we then compound the issue by drawing against Latvia and things like that. But I do think this is very sort of special interest. I don't know how many of your listeners have any interest in the Norwegian national team, but I do think our time will come. I think we have the beginnings of a good team there.
Golden generation, Lars, would you call it?
No, maybe, but I think we have the beginnings of a team that can give Erling Haaland the platform to maybe do something for us in the same way, I guess Wales were able to give Gareth Bale a platform to excel for them a few years back. I'm very confident that unless we get completely shafted by the draw, we should be in a good place to get to the Euros next time out. But we'll see. I mean, so much of international football, certainly in terms of European qualifiers, is the gods of the draw and the seeding and the stuff like that.
Well, we are getting to that point in the cycle of football where we begin to see the clubs that are the teams or the national teams or countries that are qualifying for the upcoming World Cup, which, again, if you're not paying attention, doesn't start until December of 2022. It's a winter World Cup for the first time ever, and teams are starting to qualify. Yet Europe now has this weird playoff league set up for the teams that didn't get qualified automatically out of this last round, which now includes both Portugal and Italy and Portugal are both in there. Wales is in there, so that'll be it's a very janky setup to finish out European qualifying for the World Cup, but it should be interesting all at the same time.
It's going to be absolutely savage because it's going to be a single game playoff. And if you go through the first semifinals and then finals, and it's all single game, it's not two legs. And the teams, like you mentioned, are in it are Portugal, Scotland, Italy, Russia, Sweden, Wales, Austria, North Macedonia, Turkey, Poland, Ukraine, and Czech Republic. There's some really good teams in there.
Are they playing in neutral venues, or are they playing? Does somebody get the advantage of playing at home?
So, some people, the seeded teams, get the home advantage. So that's the ones I mentioned first. Yeah.
All right.
So I think Scotland are very excited about their chances there.
Of course they are.
The Welsh were delighted to reach the playoffs again, and Wales continue to be one of those international teams that, be honest, I'm slightly jealous of, because they're one of those international teams where you sense the players really raise their games for their country. which doesn't always happen in modern football. And the players all seem to prefer playing for their country to playing for their clubs almost, which again, not that common in international football. And the bond between the team and the fans is really, really strong. So Wales are a very sympathetic team in all of this. But of course, for Italy to be in the playoffs is a disaster, and it puts them under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, the Italy situation is very strange indeed, as is Portugal. And I do, by the way, as just a side note related to everything else, I did wonder how much the Portugal situation played into the Watford game with Man U, with both with Ronaldo and Bruno Fernandes coming off that disappointing week with the international stay. Like, how much does that play into it?
Maybe, but I do wonder. I think it would be more a case of Bruno Fernandes and Cristiano Ronaldo have had 2 weeks together to discuss what they think of Solskjaer and the whole situation.
That's the angle. There you go.
Right. I do wonder.
Well, Lars, thank you so much for making yourself available on a Sunday afternoon London time. It's good to talk to you.
Very cathartic. I have to sit down and try to write something about Solskjaer now, I think. But yep. It was very useful to run through all the thoughts in my head with you. I appreciated that.
Well, I'm sorry Andy couldn't be here, because I'm sure he would have enjoyed just watching me wallow in my Manchester United misery as the Liverpool fan that he is.
Gargling on your tears.
Yeah, I sent him a text last night and told him you and I were going to do this, and he was free to join if he wanted to. And he said, no, I'm out having dinner. It's late, and I don't know how late a night it's going to be. I'm out celebrating. And I was like, celebrating what? And he sent me back an emoji, that famous gif of Klopp raising his hands celebrating something in the background, and I was like, bastard. So hopefully Andy's in bed sleeping tight. So again, thank you, Lars. We will be back live next week, Saturday after the Thanksgiving holiday. We will be live at 2:00 on The Ticket. Lars, thank you again for your time, and I hope you have a good festive week yourself, sir.
I'm sure I will do. I hope I have a great time, and thanks to all the listeners for tuning in and listening to us talk about these things. Without you doing that, it would be quite literally pointless.
The P1s love them some Lars Siverson. I hear that all the time, how much people like having you on the show. All right, speaking of the P1s, we love and adore you. Don't forget, go out, get stuck in, and win your 50s.